This is
Listen to Shoot the Defense. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Hello and welcome to Shoot the Defense on FNX, brought to you by My Sportswear, Youth Energy and Save Association. I'm your host Stel, and I'm joined by the host of YouTube channel Cheesy Forever Blue. He is a sports broadcaster, author of Reluctant Hero Colin Bell and a diary of a season in his career called Best Job in the World, not to mention 2012 Northwest Football Journalist of the Year. It's Ian Cheeseman. Ian, welcome to Shoot the Defense. Great to have you on.
Pleasure to be on.
Fantastic. Ian, before I start with the questions, mate, I need to apologise because I was actually at the Save Association press launch and I didn't see you there. You must have been about somewhere, maybe with Paul Lake or somebody.
I was sat on the front row, minding my own business really, but I was there.
I was the one asking the annoying questions, stopping the
press. I remember you.
Like, who's this Londoner? What's he doing here? Well, it's great to finally talk to you, and you're a lifelong City fan, over 2,000 games home and away under your belt. What are your earliest memories as a City fan?
Oh, blimey, going back a long way there. I mean, the first game I attended was, it's a game I'll never forget because it was the 15th of April 1970, so it's a date and a game that's etched in my mind. It was a European Cup Winners' Cup semi-final second leg, City against the German side, Schalke 04. City won 5-1. I was sat in the Platt Lane end of the ground with my mum and my dad and my uncle, and first time I was 10 years old. I desperately wanted to go and watch City, but I had a very overprotective mother. But on this particular occasion, because she was German and her nephew was coming over from Germany as a tour guide, bringing a lot of Schalke fans over. So we had a perfect excuse to actually go to the game and meet up. So while they sat and just nattered, basically, I was transfixed watching this game, finally seeing my heroes. And what a game as well, a semi-final, 5-1 home victory. Great atmosphere. Not that the bug hadn't already bit me at that stage, but I was hooked, absolutely hooked. And since then, as you say, well over 2,000 games. I got watching the reserves, the youth team, the women these days, and a lot of other games as well. Well over 1,000 other games. So I'm absolutely obsessed with watching football, and been very, very lucky to make a job out of it over the last few years.
Mm-hmm. So if I was to say Stan Bowles, Francis Lee, Mike Summerby, I presume those were the three players that you kind of look up to, and Colin Bell, obviously?
Yeah, Colin Bell's absolutely my hero. I mean, I'm quite a shy type of person anyway, and Colin, as I wrote within his book, we called it Reluctant Hero, because that's exactly what he is, was a stylish all-rounder who could do everything but didn't start shouting his mouth off. And while somebody like Rodney Marsh, for example, who came along after Colin, was another player who I loved, the fantastic skill he had and everything like that, and I've just literally been talking to him on American radio in the last hour. Great character, love him to bits, wrote part of his book as well. But he was a lot more flamboyant and a lot more outgoing, and I perhaps can't relate to that as a human being quite as much. But I like all sorts of players, whether it be the Alan Oakes, the quiet type, whether these days, or nearer, Ian Brightwell, who was another unsung hero maybe, or whether it be, you know, the players that maybe Mendy falls into that category, or Gabriel Jesus of the modern era of players who seem to love the spotlight and seem to like, you know, the chance to show off and do what they do. I love all types of players, but that's where it all started for me back in 1970, and here I am now, excited more than you can express on what is happening to my football club in this day and age.
I can imagine, mate. I can imagine. So, can you describe the rivalry between City and United from a supporter's perspective when you were in your teens, and has it changed much over the years?
Yeah, it's certainly changed from a United perspective, because they now see City as a threat, whereas for many years they didn't. So they're, You know, you could say that they focused their rivalry on Liverpool a little bit more. From City's perspective, you know, in the days when I was first going along to games, there wasn't an awful lot of difference between City and United, but we all know that United dominated for so many years, winning the treble, winning a hatful of trophies, whereas City went into this almighty slump. And, you know, there was an era, I've got a couple of sons, for example, you know, and going to school and being a City fan was not something that they particularly enjoyed, because in a class of 30, there might have been one or two City fans and, you know, 19 or 20 United fans, and that was difficult for them. And, you know, but they stuck through it, and now they've come out the other side. So the rivalry from City's perspective, I think, has always been there. There's always been this sort of living in the shadow type of thing. And in English tribal football, which, you know, you know as well as I know, is very, very strong and passionate, is something that I believe is pretty unique in football. I mean, I've travelled all over the world and been to all sorts of sporting venues, and of course there are rivalries, but the tribalism that exists in this country is on a different level. So I don't like to use the word hate, because it just is not a word that should be in people's vocabulary on any level, whether it be in football or life. Respect and all those sorts of things are words I'd rather use. But as long as you take it in the right context, then I think it's fair to say that City fans, and now maybe United fans a little bit more, have a mutual hatred of each other, which adds to the fun, as long as it doesn't become too venomous. You know, it's like, let's put it this way, it's like going along to a pantomime and booing the villain. You know, there's nothing wrong with that, as long as you don't go further than that. And we know that there are some idiots who do, but, you know, there's nothing wrong with actually hating the pantomime villain, is there?
No,
and that's
no.
How I would see United as.
Fair enough. Well, I remember going to the 50th anniversary game in Munich. It happened to be the weekend when United played City, and the minute silence, you know, you could hear a pin drop, and that just shows the mutual respect between City and United. I mean, believe it or not, there is that respect there. It's like what you said, there is that hatred, but there is that respect. I think it goes back to when Old Trafford was bombed, wasn't it?
Yeah, I suppose you could go back that far. I mean, at the end of the day, we're all football fans. We might have different tribal allegiances, but we have something in common with each other that perhaps the outside world who don't get football have. So, you know, if I'm in the company of a United fan who goes along to games like I do, then there is a huge mutual respect. Yeah, there'll be a bit of banter. And probably in each other's company, the word hatred is far too strong. As I say, I'm not a fan of that word anyway. But, you know, that, of course, there's a togetherness among football supporters, and so there should be all around the world. And, you know, you see it whenever something terrible happens, and, you know, the less of those incidents happen, the better. But every now and again, when something terrible happens, you know, you see that the coming together of supporters of all different football clubs, and that's always as it should be. I mean, I'm a fan at heart, even though I've been a journalist for a long time. You don't go to over 2,000 games of one particular team just because you're a journalist. I mean, even now, that I think I'm up to 2,035, something like that.
Wow.
and only about 800 of them were as a journalist.
Wow.
The vast majority are still as a fan. So I always have been, am, and always will be a football supporter first and foremost, who just considers myself very lucky to have found a way for many, many years, and hopefully into the future, of funding my job, and also getting a few insights into the behind the scenes that ordinary football supporters are not always lucky enough to have.
That's right. And you go way back with this. I mean, we're talking about the football special trains. What was it like being a steward on them in the 70s?
Interesting, because of course football hooligans existed a lot more in those days, and the way that came about was because I actually got a lift off a football special, a train. I remember being at Wolverhampton Station after City had just played Wolves in a game, and I was waiting for the normal train, and my ticket was for a normal train, but these football specials were charter trains, so private trains effectively, so you weren't allowed to go on those unless you had bought a charter ticket. And some of the lads who were on it, some of the people in charge who recognised me and knew me, wondered why I wasn't getting on their train. And I said, well, my ticket's not valid. And they let me on their train. And I felt guilty that I was there and I really shouldn't be. So I ended up helping and selling raffle tickets. And before you knew where you were, I was selling pies and drinks and sandwiches. And what there used to be a postal wagon at one end of the trains. They called it the cage. It had like a metal grate and a metal fence, and it could be locked up when you got to the other end. So the supporters club would bring along all these drinks and chocolates and sandwiches and stuff, not to make a profit, just to be a service, really. And I ended up for many, many years selling the pies and the sausage rolls and all the rest of it to the supporters. And what that meant was that I could travel for free. I didn't get paid to do it, but I got free travel, which, since my number one goal was always to be at all the games, anything that could keep the cost down and make it more manageable was exactly where I wanted to be. But the football specials were fun, often full of 500 absolute passionate City fans. I remember coming back from a game at Brighton where it had been absolutely pouring down throughout the game, especially in the end where the City fans were. And the fans came back soaked to the skin. And for a 4 or 5 hour train journey back to Manchester, they had their clothes hanging over all every available pipe on the football special, drying out, and they were all walking about in their underwear, which must have been hilarious for anybody who would see the train roll into a station and look at this train and think, my God, all these people have got no clothes on that train. What's going on? You know, there were one or two incidents with, you know, I remember a train being burnt out once, you know, but just because something went wrong. I can remember trains being bricked by opposition supporters. So there were ups and downs of it, but I wouldn't want to not have had that experience. They were interesting and very rich and rewarding times, I have to say.
I can imagine, mate. I can imagine. Well, look, you're on Twitter, and you know these days there are individuals on Twitter known as ITKs, but you actually worked for the original ITKs, being Club Cool. What was that like?
Yeah, well, that was another opportunity that came my way because, you know, Club Call was something that was just starting out. It was very expensive, of course, 0898 number, and you could, if you listened to a commentary all the way through, it probably would have cost you, you know, I wouldn't like to put a, you know, 150, 200 quid, which might not sound a lot now, although it is still a lot to me, but, you know, it would have been absolutely outrageous at the time. So people dipped in and out for bits of commentary or whatever. I'd been volunteering at hospital radio at the time. Somebody heard me doing something and invited me to get involved. And again, it was an opportunity for me to develop a new skill set, to sit in a press box, to mix with people, to network, all these types of things. And, you know, to actually have a chance to commentate, which it was a dream of mine to do something like that. So although it wasn't something I necessarily morally thought was right top of the list sort of thing, it was something I couldn't resist. Although I'll tell you famously that once Club Call rang me up and said, we want you to do a game for us next Tuesday. And I said, go on, yeah, what's the game then? He said, it's Liverpool against Spurs in the League Cup at Anfield. And this was, you know, 30, 35 years ago, right? So he said, it's 50 quid. And I thought, 50 quid? Wow, that's great. You know, that's really good money, that. I'm sorry, though, I can't do it. So he said, why can you not do it? So I said, well, City are playing at Torquay on that night in the League Cup. So they said, oh, are you working down there then? You're doing a commentary for us down there? I said, no, I'm going as a fan. So they said, but will you not being paid at all? I said, well, quite the contrary. I'll be paying to go down there, you know, book time off from my normal job. And they just could not get their head round how I was turning down an opportunity living near Manchester to do a 45-minute drive to Liverpool to watch Liverpool against Tottenham and get well paid for it, rather than go under my own steam to Torquay against City. I can't remember what the Liverpool-Spurs game was like or the result, but in the back of my mind I've got a feeling it might have finished 3-2 and been a bit of a thriller. But what I can tell you for sure is that City drew 0-0 at Torquay, and it was a terrible, terrible game. But did I ever regret that decision? No.
That's brilliant. That's a fantastic story. That's a very, very good story. Well, Ian, you spent 23 years at the BBC, mate. City's correspondent. You witnessed the dark days and obviously recent success. As an ardent City fan, how difficult was it to remain professional during the highs and lows?
I've got to say that as a football fan, I'm quite a boring football fan, and I'm quite a studious football fan. So even though in the last 6 months in particular, I've been going in the away end with the City fans, when everybody else is jumping up and down and effing and jeffing and having a go at the referee or whatever, even though I might share their views, I tend to be far more cerebral, shall we say, and far more controlled. So therefore, making the adjustment to being a commentator on the BBC and being in control, I didn't find particularly difficult, even though other people said, you know, that they were surprised that I hadn't sworn or done this, that and the other. Now, if you listen to any of my commentaries in the past, you will know that I was a very passionate commentator and a very emotional commentator. And actually, I loved channeling what was inside me that I don't always show on the outside, in a way that where people could have an insight into what really I was thinking and how I really was feeling. So it was never a problem for me dealing with all that sort of stuff. And actually now I desperately, desperately miss commentating. Maybe I'll never do it again. Thankfully, I did it through some great times, some great moments that can never, ever be repeated, and I was behind the mic for those, so for that I'm very, very grateful. I didn't particularly find that difficult. That's not to say that commentary itself isn't difficult, and I took it very seriously and tried to fine-tune my own skills to the best ability that I could do. And as I say, I do miss it now, but it wasn't something I had a problem with, that, but that's probably just because I'm boring.
Go on the contrary, come on now. Well, I remember reading an article about Francis Lee's time as chairman. I know he admitted spending too much money on a new stand instead of investing in new players, but that wasn't the main reason for the club's demise, was it? I mean, I heard a lot of City's players actually didn't even bat an eyelid after the 5-0 loss against United.
It was a different era of players. There were good ones and there were bad ones, just as there are in the game now. I mean, you've only got to look at what happened in this recent transfer window with players wanting to go and, you know, knowing whether they'll now be in the right frame of mind, which to us, looking from the outside, seems ludicrous, because we'd give a limb to play for our clubs and probably do it for nothing. So we can't quite understand why players don't think that way. Back in the Francis Lee days, the whole club was different. The whole way that football was financed was different. The amount of money that was coming in from television and all that sort of thing was different. Main Road was an old ground that needed a lot of money spending on it. United were mega successful, and you know, as I touched on before, probably a lot of the kids would have naturally more gravitated towards going there. So the club was struggling, and Francis Lee came in on a white charger, you know, to save the club. And at the time when he came in, all the fans were behind him, including me. And I still hold Francis Lee in the very highest esteem and know that what he tried to do and the fact that he was prepared to put his neck on the line was very, very admirable. But he was swimming against the tide to a certain extent with the whole way that football was in them days, and certainly the situation at City were in when he took over. So he tried his best. It didn't work out in the end. He came at a time when people were desperate, you know, and there'll be clubs now, clubs who would be in a similar position to City, where City were in them days. So let's take another club in the northwest like Oldham Athletic, and say at the moment, you know, that they're probably looking for new investors. And if a new investor did come in, they'd be saying, "Wow, I didn't realise you're in all this trouble, and I didn't realise this needed doing and that needed doing." But when the club is desperate, they'll accept whoever comes along. And Francis Lee, as a former player and as a hero, was absolutely the right man to lead that at the time. And I think he fulfilled a great role. He was instrumental in the Commonwealth Stadium plans originally. And I know he's a big fan of the academy. And, you know, look at where City are now with the new stadium, which they've benefited from. And without the new stadium, maybe they wouldn't have got the new owners. So I think he has a lot to be proud of, Francis Lee. But at that particular time, in the end, it was probably too much for him. So, I mean, it went a lot deeper after he went. Bernstein and John Wardle came in, and John Wardle was another magnificent man who was putting hands in his own pockets, and you don't know how close the club came to going out of existence. He's an absolute unsung hero of Manchester City. But then, of course, with Shinawatra, because of the new stadium and because of the situation that the club was in at the time, it transformed the club initially, even though he probably wasn't the right man either. But as a result of that, here we are in the glory days, if you like, the days of Sheikh Mansour. And at the moment, City fans are still just pinching themselves every day.
Yeah. Well, look, you mentioned Shinawatra. I'll mention him in a moment. Liverpool playing City this weekend. And there's a game I want to bring to your attention, which obviously you probably don't want me to, but have you forgiven Steve Lomas for 96?
Steve Lomas was an absolute warrior, and he came up through City's youth team. And when somebody plays with the attitude that he has and had, and he's one of you, even though he's an Irishman, but he was a City player through and through. You can forgive anything, and mistakes and misjudging situations and all that sort of thing. They're human traits. We all make mistakes. So the answer to that question is, yeah, of course, I forgive him.
Great, fantastic. Just going to get that clear,
Yeah.
Two quick questions, which I don't really know the answers to, obviously. Yellow bananas, what are they about?
There's a bloke called Frank Newton who took along a banana because his mate couldn't go to the game. This is how I understand the story. And he was walking past a shop one day, vegetable greengrocer shop, and saw a big inflatable banana in the window. And he took this banana and he put a scarf around it and a hat on it, and it was to replace his mate. And it sort of just seemed to catch on. And these days we'd call it going viral. If it was on social media, it'd go viral.
Yeah.
And it got to the stage where every club had different inflatables. I remember Berry being the black, had black puddings, inflatable black puddings. And Oldham had the yard dogs because of got called yard dogs at one stage, and we've seen obviously beach balls and inflatable rafts and all sorts of things being thrown around. But the City bananas were started by a very what seemed like innocent situation, and City had a player around about that time called Imre Varadi.
That's right.
So it became Imre Banana as well. So that's what football fans are like. City fans in particular have always been known for the humour and the self-deprecating attitude. I loved all that. I remember going into a game at Stoke on Boxing Day one year. Everybody's in fancy dress. Everybody's got an inflatable. Things like that. And a lot more now. You see it at cricket and all sorts of stuff. But that was all groundbreaking at that particular time. And it's all part of the folklore, really, isn't it?
That's right. And Niall Quinn's disco pants. I don't. What is that?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm not sure how any of that started, but Niall, I've had Niall on programmes that I've presented, and he's talked about all that, the nickname and things like that, all with a great deal of fondness and love and affection. And I mean, I had Sean Goulter in the studio with me this week on a radio programme, and he was singing his own song, which I thought was a bit bizarre, feed the goat and he will score and all that, Players all love that type of thing. It's different than just going along to sterile games in sterile stadiums, and there's more and more people, we know that, who are paying exorbitant amounts now to be corporately entertained and to have premium seats, and none of those people get that. But it's the older fan, and when I say older, I don't necessarily mean in age, but the fans who have the mindset of it being about having fun, first and foremost. And it's not just, I know there's a big deal made these days about the products on the field and the quality of the players, but it's not just about that. It's about actually having fun, you know, going with your mates to games. Now, you know, the number of times I've sat in a car going to an away game with my mates, and I know you'll say, from your point of view, you look at this and go, well, that's because City were rubbish for so long. But I bet this happens in a lot of cars, where the fans are sitting there going, they're saying to each other, you know, who's the worst player you've ever seen play for City? Who's the worst goalkeeper we've ever had? And they're laughing hysterically and love recalling the terrible times and the terrible incidents as much as they like to talk about the Sergio Aguero goal against QPR. You know, because that's, it's that colour, it's that, the ups and downs of it all that make it special. It isn't about, you know, consistency and winning 1-0 every week. It's about fun. Yeah. Life's about fun, for goodness sake. Yeah. And being a football fan, if you treat it right, it's about having fun. So, yeah, there is tribal rivalry, and as I say, I was careful to use the word hatred, but we're all cut from the same cloth. We're all the same. We all have fun, and we all want to have fun. And, you know, once that's gone, then that's a real worry then.
Absolutely, no, I agree. Couldn't agree with you more, mate. So let's talk about Taksin Shinawatra. When he took over, did it concern you, given his assets were actually frozen by the military government?
Yeah, the whole Taksin Shinawatra thing did concern me. It needed something to come in, but perhaps not him. Maybe now, looking back in retrospect, when we know how it all ended, it was a good thing that he came in. But I remember being at the launch of his regime in Albert Square in City Centre Manchester, and they had free Thai food for everybody that came along. And this sounds terrible, and I don't want to be misquoted in any of this, but you know, it felt like a Nuremberg rally, you know, sitting there with him sat in this chair overlooking everything and everybody, you know, praising how great he was. And we all do that to a certain extent for our favourite teams and favourite footballers. But there was something about Shinawatra that always made me feel a little bit uncomfortable. As I say now, with the enjoyment of hindsight, you know, the privilege, I should say, of hindsight, we can all say now as City supporters, thank goodness Shinawatra came along, but thank goodness he sold out and went, you know, because in the end, everything's turned out for the best. But if Shinawatra was still in charge now, well, he wouldn't be, would he? But if he was, I don't think the City story would have gone in the direction it did.
No, I doubt it. I mean, put this right, fortunately, his tenure didn't last as long as these Nuremberg rallies, really.
No, true enough.
Well, look, you know, he brought in Sven-Göran Eriksson, and he only lasted a season. I remember there was a Save Our Sven campaign. Was he really that adored?
Yeah, he was, absolutely. There was a march on the day of his last game. And I mean, City, believe it or not, lost at Middlesbrough. I think it was 8-1 that day. You know, that was his last game in charge. And even that day, the fans were still singing Sven's name. He was such a gentleman. He was a lovely, lovely man to deal with. I mean, I've been privileged down the years to meet and talk to most of the managers that have been in charge of City since I started. And there's no bigger gentleman than Sven-Göran Eriksson. You know, lovely, lovely man, and he identified some good players. I mean, Ilano was one of the players that he brought in, for example, who, all right, people not necessarily think of him as the greatest player. He's sort of forgotten about, really, but I still say that a fully fit Ilano, at the stage he came into City, would fit into this team absolutely perfectly now, and would have been, I think, more appreciated than he was in that particular era, because City had one or two individuals every now and again, you know, like Kinkladze, who I know is also a divisive figure. But you know, when there's only one or two of you in the team, and you're just looking at the game and thinking about the game completely differently than the rest of them, you know, sort of Kinkladze finds Pollock, doesn't have the same ring to it as Ilano finds Rubinho, finds Kinkladze, you know, finds De Bruyne or whatever. You know what I mean? You've got to have players that are on the same wavelength and think the same way. And unfortunately, Ilano at that time wasn't. But it just shows that Sven could identify players, in my opinion, you know, and although his career has been, I suppose, a bit up and down, if you look at it over the years, he was very, very popular at City. And I think Those who were around at the time will always remember him with fondness, really.
Yeah, I remember because he was at Shakhtar, wasn't he? He had a fantastic couple of seasons then. And after City, went to Galatasaray, didn't do too much, ended up back in Brazil, then played in India, I think. But I remember he was a fantastic dead ball player.
Yeah, I just think he was a great footballer generally. Great skills, just very, very natural at what he did. And a player I will always remember as one of my fondest, really.
Yeah, I can imagine. So, along came Sheikh Mansour. He's obviously changed the demographic of Man City, shaped the scope of the club, the mechanics. It's not what City have done on the pitch that has impressed me most. It's what they've done off the pitch with the academy, with what they've done to the local community. They've invested very well. They brought in a lot of youngsters, from local schools and whatnot.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot more to come from what they've already done already, because the land around the main stadium is yet to be developed. But they've been working with Manchester City Council to develop new housing. There's a sixth form college just off the campus, which has been funded by City. The academy itself is phenomenal. I mean, it's probably as good as anything in world football, to be honest. There's a mini stadium here. I'm sat in the car looking at the mini stadium at the moment, having been to the press conference earlier. It's got a capacity of 7,000. It houses the main offices of the club as well. And then just to the left of where I'm looking is this circular building, one side of which is devoted to first team activities and the other side is devoted to youth and women, etc. In the middle of it is an enclosed roof pitch and an open pitch, which are private, which they can use even for doing. I don't think they do it too often, but they have got the capability of actually lowering the temperature, for example, inside the roofed stadium to try and mimic ahead. They might do it, for example, ahead of the Shakhtar game in December if they think it's of value, but they could drop the temperature of that it's a full-size pitch inside, by the way, but drop the temperature to maybe -5 or something and let the players train in that for the week before, you know, the game that they play at Shakhtar to sort of acclimatise them to it and that type of thing. So it's got all that. Obviously, they've got a circular dressing room in there that has doors that lead off in different directions to hydrotherapy and the training pitch and just everything very thought through as to how they want to do it, the kitchen and the putting the food back inside you when you've trained. So they've thought of everything. There's a sort of 15, 16 full-size pitches outside as well, where different age groups train, and it's all linked by a bridge over to the main stadium. So it is all absolutely state-of-the-art, and it must be a great recruiting tool for young players who, they're trying to tempt to come along and be perhaps the next generation of City players.
That's right. So when Tiki Begiristan turned up in 2012, did you have a feeling or an inkling that Guardiola would turn up eventually?
To be honest, I felt that as soon as Guardiola left Barcelona, City made their move and wanted Guardiola right from the outset. I think Soriano and Cheeky Begiristain were obviously part of an attempt to, in some ways, not in every sense, but in some ways, to mimic what had happened at Barcelona, that model of the being a world brand led by playing the beautiful game in the most beautiful way possible. And I certainly have enjoyed watching Barcelona over the years, and I do buy into all that. And I think Pep being very close to those two, particularly to Cheeky Begiristain, who he played in the same team with at one stage. I think, yes, part of the reason for bringing them in was to ultimately get Pep. And I think they made a play for him before he had his one-year sabbatical and then his 3 years in Bayern Munich. And I think verbally, although nobody's ever confirmed this, but my feeling was that Pep had already verbally said that he would go to City once his time at Bayern was up. So I always felt that Manuel Pellegrini, for example, was a long-term, albeit, but a caretaker manager to see City through to that time. And during that period when Pellegrini was in charge, all this academy was built. So I think it was all part of getting it all ready, if you like, for when Pep Guardiola arrived.
Yeah. See, the thing is, with Guardiola, he seems to be somewhere in the middle between Mancini and Pellegrini in terms of a personality. Here you've got Mancini, who's a fiery Italian, you know, wears his heart on his sleeve. He had a couple of, altercations with Balotelli. And then you've got Pellegrini, who's this placid individual. And you've got, as I said, Pep is kind of in the middle, isn't he?
Yeah, I can see what you're saying there. I mean, you know, Pellegrini was the type of manager who, nice man that he was, and absolute charming gentleman that he was, you tended to sit in his press conferences and even observe him on the touchline and be tempted to sort of nod off. It's easy to forget that Pellegrini, though, won the Premier League, albeit with, you could argue, Mancini's team that had been sort of left over in a League Cup, and they never had a disastrous season under Manuel Pellegrini, so he did a very good job. And actually, you know, I'm sure in years to come people will probably sort of forget Manuel Pellegrini because of his personality, even though this is a man, and at the moment there are only four that have done it in City's history. Four different managers have won the top division of English football, and one of them is Manuel Pellegrini. Now, obviously, back in the 50s when, you know, and the 30s, when City were winning the first title, that's sort of part of history that's probably now consigned to only those who lived in that era. Joe Mercer did it in 68. Mancini did the most famous one of all in 2012. But Pellegrini in 2014, especially if Pep does it in the future, I think might be sort of almost the forgotten man, you know. But you're right that Pep's somewhere in between the two, really, in terms of he's got his own unique personality, but somewhere in between the two, yeah.
Fantastic. And that first title when you mentioned under Mancini, what did that mean to you as a City fan? And what do you think it meant to the club? Was that a stepping stone, do you think?
Oh, for the club, absolutely, massively the direction they wanted to go in. You know what they're all about now. You can see it. They've got sister clubs in Japan and in Melbourne and in New York and now Girona, and they're looking at a team in Uruguay, and they're looking at another smaller club in the English league setup. You know that they want to expand the City Football Group wide and far. You know, and that was absolutely key to what they're trying to do. And the way that they did it was, you know, notorious, if you like. It was one of those things that, you know, was seen all around the world and is remembered by people all around the world. So I think if they'd have beaten QPR that day 3-0 in the way they should have done, it wouldn't have had the impact that in the end it did by winning it with such drama. I mean, speaking as a fan who, you know, has been going home and away through all those testing times, shall we say, to win the Premier League was a dream that I thought would never happen. To do it in the way that it was done, I mean, I was behind the microphone that day, and for it to happen in that way where both the goals were scored in stoppage time, where it looked like it was going to end up being the ultimate tribal nightmare in that United would win the league that day just because of City's incompetence, because that's how it would have been viewed, to not have beaten QPR when the title was theirs. To come back from that and to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat was just the most amazing thing that no matter how long I live, or how short I live for that matter, that will always be in my footballing life by far the best day of my life, which will never, ever, ever be equaled. And if City won 10 titles, 15 titles, 10 European Cups, there will be nothing to match that victory on that particular day. Although I'd love to see him win a European Cup, because that's the one thing now that's left in my portfolio that I haven't seen as a fan.
There you go. Well, that's a great segue to my final two questions before I let you go. The first one is, do you think Guardiola knows his best 11? Because we've seen him change his system over the past couple of seasons. You know, he started with playing, you know, full-backs in central midfield, and this season he started off with a 3-5-2 at Brighton. Do you think the squad that he's got, he's happy with? Is he content with what he's got?
I don't think he has. But honestly, let me ask you the question. You know, who is City's best 11? Do you know? You know, now that isn't meant to be. I'm not criticising. You're not having The point I'm trying to make there is that I don't know what City's best 11 is. I don't think there's a player out there who is in his squad who knows who the best 11 is, and probably Pep doesn't either. But I think also that, and I can say this as a person who's lived through, you know, a lot of football over a long period of time. There was a period where when Liverpool were winning their European Cups and their league titles, when United were winning their leagues, you could name their starting 11. When City won the league in 68, I could probably do it now, name the starting 11, the strongest 11. And the only thing that happened was when a player got injured or suspended or something, a player came in and it was known right from the minute he stepped in the team that he was deputising for that other player. Modern football, not just City, every club at the top level, I don't believe has strongest 11 anymore. It doesn't matter if it's Real Madrid. You know, Isco last season, was he a regular starter? Was he in Real Madrid's strongest 11? And yet right now, maybe he is. But in another few weeks, he might not be anymore. And I don't believe that City have a strongest 11. I don't believe that Pep has a first choice 11, an ideal 11 or anything. You know, this week as we're speaking, City play Liverpool on Saturday and then play Feyenoord the following Wednesday, a big Champions League game, the first in the group. Will he play the same 11 in both games? I don't think there's a chance of him doing that. You know, which game will he prioritise? I don't think he will prioritise one or the other. So, but, you know, if he was, would he pick his strongest 11 for this one or the strongest 11 on Wednesday? I think those days have gone. That simplistic way of looking at it have gone. I think, you know, tactics, opposition, fitness levels, you know, they're all factors now. And if City had done what they wanted to do and signed Alexis Sanchez in the window, they'd have had three strikers of absolute top quality: Gabriel Jesus, Sergio Aguero, and Alexis Sanchez. He would never ever play all three of those in the same game. So therefore, every time he picked two of them or one of them, somebody somewhere would be saying, ah, that's the one he prefers. Well, then the next week, they'd be saying, oh, it seems to have gone for him this week. No, it's about rotating, and it's about managing a club and a team throughout an entire season. So I think, you know, the way we look at football has and is changing, and we've got to think a different way.
Yeah, that's right. Well, look, on a final note, my main criticism of Guardiola has always been his defensive side of the game. Going forward, his teams have been fantastic. We've seen Barcelona destroy teams. We've seen Bayern Munich do it. And even City to some extent, especially at the beginning of the last season where they went 10 games on the bounce, winning games. But as I said, defensively, I'm not sure he's got that right formula there. That being said, how far do you think he can take Man City? Can he do what the Arabs want him to do and claim that European title?
Well, there is one question that I have asked about the defence. I did a column in the Manchester Evening News this week and I highlighted it in that. I'm a dreamer. The two international teams that I absolutely fell in love with were both Brazil sides. One in 70, the all-conquering Brazil team with Rivelino, Pelé, Jairzinho and all the rest of it. But I was only a kid then. In 82, yeah. I studied the team that had Eder, Socrates, Falcao and all the rest of them in it. What a great team. Loved watching them. They played an Italy team. They had a second group stage at that stage in the World Cup. There were three in it and they all played each other once. And Brazil lost to Italy and were knocked out at that stage 3-2. Paolo Rossi scored the three goals and who'd just come back from a ban for, I think, match fixing or something. And they played, the Italians, completely on the counter-attack. I think they had three chances in the game and scored. Brazil completely dominated them, completely played what I consider to be the most beautiful football that you can play. And it ultimately ended in failure. We saw a few years ago Chelsea win the Champions League in a season where they just didn't play well in that competition. They defended. They had a bit of luck, of course, because it's a cup competition. And they played on the counter-attack and they won the competition. The one fear I've got is that Pep Guardiola's team, as much as I love it and as much as I support it and as much as I want that structure to work, is flawed in the sense that it is built to attack, but it is vulnerable to cynical counter-attacking football. And whilst I would always, no matter who the teams were, want the more purist version of football to win, the reality in life is that that doesn't always happen. So I so much want Pep Guardiola to succeed, so much hope that his template works, but the fear I have lurking in the back of my mind, because it hurt me back in 1982 when that Italian, and it's left a scar on me, and that defeat to that Brazil team really hurt me, but it's made me realise that it's not always the best team, the most romantic team, the dreamy team that wins. You know, sometimes it is the cynical team, sometimes it is, dare I say, the team that cheats, you know, that wins. I can't tell you how much I want Pep to succeed, but my fear is that City are a little bit vulnerable to counter-attacking. Vincent Kompany has been subject to injury concerns. John Stones isn't a real defender in my eyes. So City, and they didn't get the defender that they wanted in the transfer window in Johnny Evans or anybody else that I might have gone for. So certainly this season at the moment, that worries me. But in terms of the whole philosophy, I am slightly concerned that the philosophy may be flawed, but I so much hope I'm wrong on that.
Great stuff. Well, Ian, thank you ever so much for agreeing to come on the show. It's been absolutely fantastic talking to you, especially about Man City. How can our listeners get in contact with you on Twitter?
Very simple. I mean, everything I do centres around my Twitter account. So anything, vlogs, for example, that I do on match days at City, or the YouTube channel, anything I do on there, or the Manchester News column, or XS Manchester, or present a radio programme, it's always downloadable as a podcast. And I'm hoping to start a podcast as well myself and launch me on iancheeseman.co.uk website fairly soon. But the thing is, if you follow me on Twitter, at Ian Cheeseman, very simple, cheese as in, you know, on toast, cheese man, Ian Cheeseman, then I pop links on there to everything I do. So one way or another, you can navigate to anything you want to see that I do via at Ian Cheeseman. So follow me on there and look out for everything on there.
That's right. You do regular updates, especially when it comes to the press conferences, which are quite handy, especially for fans that obviously can't be there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I can't wait to go to Feyenoord next week. I'm travelling with two City supporters who I've travelled to a lot of the European games within the last couple of years. They're good fun lads. And you know, we always do some sort of cheap version of the route. I think the whole trip's not costing us very much because I've got to keep my costs down. So we're driving down to Calais, going over to Dunkirk, landing at Dunkirk the day before the game. That sounds like a headline already, doesn't it? And then driving over to Rotterdam, and all that will be in the vlog that I do next week. And hopefully it gives people who are interested in it a proper fan's eye view of a match day and what real fans do on a match day. And hopefully it'll be fun as well. So, you know, if you don't watch anything else, watch that one.
Absolutely. I'll look forward to watching that, mate. Well, look, again, you're more than welcome to come back on again, Ian. I really hope you can, because I'll have to put on an eye petition like the City fans did to have you as the voice of City's match days. So
I'm not going to get involved in anything like that. I never will. But it was so nice that I could see people actually cared enough to start things like that. What I don't want to become is a political animal. I don't want anybody at the club or anywhere that I work, in fact, to think that I'm orchestrating anything like that, because they've accused me of it in the past. I've never been involved in it at all. But the support that I've had from City supporters in particular during the last 7 or 8 months, which have not been easy for me, because I won't go into it, but have not been easy for me, have meant the world to me, and people starting petitions and stuff like that has been unbelievably uplifting for me. So if anybody's listening who's involved in that, thank you. I can't endorse you or support you, but I do thank you.
Great stuff. Well, again, Ian, thank you very much for your time, mate. Really appreciate it, and I'll speak to you soon.
No problem.